Hello, I'm Earl Fontenelle, and you're listening to The Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast, online at schwepp.net. Special episode, coming back for more Part 6, The Roots of Christian Reincarnationism. Well, gentle listeners, things are about to get very interesting and rather esoteric in our series. Interesting because, of course, as we all know, Christians have never believed in reincarnation, right? Well, spoiler alert, in the first centuries of the Christian movement, reincarnation, in fact, figures very prominently among the many different models put forth by Christians as to what happens after you die. So that is interesting, but esoteric in that a lot of our evidence for belief in reincarnation among early Christians seems to be formulated as esoteric teaching. We'll get more into the evidence for that in the coming episodes on a case-by-case basis, but much evidence, it seems to me, points in a direction of one teaching about the afterlife for the masses of Christians, and a second inner teaching for the elite, the knowers, sometimes as with Clement of Alexandria, known as the Gnostics, and sometimes this inner teaching is one of reincarnation. Now, you will have noticed that our evidence for reincarnation in Judaism up to the end of the Second Temple period, discussed in the last two episodes, was thin on the ground and also very difficult to interpret. Now, with the rise of Christianity, we have much more evidence, though still difficult to interpret. That's a good thing on the face of it, although it is in fact the product of a very sad state of affairs, namely that our access to the texts of antiquity is largely determined by the curatorial filter of the Middle Ages, which means for the Greco-Roman world, the preferences of about a millennium of Christian copyists. So they're editing what we can read. On the Jewish side, an analogous though different process occurs, whereby the huge corpus of rabbinic literature grows up over hundreds of years, incorporating indeed very much from earlier strata of Jewish thought, but also leaving much more on the cutting room floor. So much of what we know about the vastly varied schools of Judaism, or Judaisms, as some scholars want to say, of the Second Temple period, is through papyri and things like that, that if we just read the rabbinic material, we just wouldn't know that these Judaisms had ever flourished. So much has been lost as regards polytheist thought, Judaism, and early forms of Christianity, which did not eventually make the cut from this kind of medieval filter on our data. There are a few important sources of evidence which buck this trend. The Qumran or Dead Sea Scrolls are records of one form of Judaism which didn't make the cut, the rabbinic cut. The papyri from Elephantine in Egypt are another such record. The magic bowls are another record. And in the case of Christianity, we have the Nag Hammadi Library, a trove of many, many Christian documents or documents of interest to certain late antique Christians of, let's say, unorthodox tastes. And they did not make the cut, along with a few other delightful finds that we have, such as the text known as Pistis Sophia, a late antique Christian text, which is very much not canonical in Orthodox Christianity, and which survives in Coptic thanks to the friendly, dry climate of Egypt. We'll be talking about the Pistis Sophia next time. So we shall be delving quite deeply into those sources of evidence in what is to come, especially the Nag Hammadi texts. But it's worth maybe making this explicit at the outset. Reincarnation will end up being anathematized by Orthodox Christianity. I'm oversimplifying because there is no one voice for Orthodox Christianity, but let's certainly say that in the Catholic Church and in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, and in any of the major Christian denominations which still exist to this day, reincarnation is specifically not a correct take on eschatology. Now, in the next few episodes, we're going to be looking for traces of what we know existed, early Christian belief in reincarnation, and the conversation is going to get very complex. So let's make a first few explanatory global remarks here right at the beginning. First of all, we're going to be dealing with a lot of very different types of literature. We have early Christian speculations about reincarnation in the broad milieu of Christian writings from the first 4 centuries CE. These include everything from the New Testament writings themselves, which we're going to get to in a minute, through a number of Jewish Christian texts showing very little influence from Greco-Roman philosophic thought. So if they're talking about reincarnation, they're not talking about something coming from Plato or Pythagoras. They're talking about an evolving Jewish tradition about reincarnation. All the way to another side of the spectrum, early Christian theologians, many of them, as with the Alexandrians, Basilides, Carpocrates, Clement, and Origen, deeply engaged with both Greek philosophical ideas and with late Second Temple Jewish thought, and so creating wild syntheses of these cultural streams. Quite different sorts of texts, right? A text which presents a post-mortem vision of Christ to one of the apostles, where Christ explains how reincarnation works in the symbolic language of apocalyptic literature, is something quite different genre-wise from systematic theology, like the type we see in Origen's On First Principles or Contra Kelsum. So that's one point we have to keep in mind, like the bewildering range of genres we're going to be looking at, and we have to be very sensitive to the rules of interpretation that a given genre sort of imposes. Now, a second point to make is that much of our evidence for early Christian reincarnationism comes from a hostile but artificial source. I refer to the heresiological tradition, the heresiological writers. Why do I say hostile but artificial? Well, who are the heresiologists? From the early history of the Jesus movement, there were attempts to set the brethren straight on what this new thing is supposed to be about, right? There's a lot of arguments going on, a lot of kind of back and forth about what do we believe about this? What do we believe, you know, believe about that? We see this impulse already in the writings attributed to Paul of Tarsus, the Pauline letters in the New Testament, who quite early in the first century is writing letters to all these different churches and sometimes admonishing them, telling them things like, I hear you are worshiping angels. Don't do that. We don't do that. Or, it has come to my attention that you have been listening to these teachers. Don't listen to them. Listen to me instead. Then in the second century at Rome, we have Justin Martyr, an educated Greek-speaking convert who wrote a number of works for a non-Christian audience, arguing that Christianity was not a sinister antisocial cult, but in fact a salutary influence and a true religion in the Roman sense. Justin, we know, also wrote a now lost work of heresiology, attacking thinkers like Basilides, whose distinctive teachings were, for Justin, contrary to true Christianity. Then we have Irenaeus, Bishop of Lyon in the later second century, who wrote a very widely read heresiological manual called On the Detection and Overthrow of the So-Called Gnosis, but more commonly known as Against Heresies or Against the Schools of Thought. Then we have a work known as The Refutation of All Heresies, written shortly after Irenaeus' work. This is a book which survives now in a very complex, fragmentary state, and you'll often see it cited as by one Hippolytus or pseudo-Hippolytus, but we don't actually have any reason to attribute authorship to this thing. It's the whole Hippolytus idea is a scholarly conjecture. Then we have Eusebius of Caesarea, who didn't exactly write heresiology in the 4th century, but did go on little excursus here and there, condemning various contemporary Christian theories in the course of his works of church history and theology. And we have many others. This is a kind of sampling of some important heresiological writers whose works survive from the first 4 centuries. Now, here is our twofold problem with these sources: the problematicness and the artificiality. The first problem is obvious. These are polemical sources, such that when they tell us about a brand of Christian thought they don't like, they're motivated by the aim of condemning and trashing that brand of thought. And this raises a lot of questions about their portrayals. But the second problem is actually more insidious, in my view: the artificiality. Because this particular heresiological tradition only survives precisely because it is the tradition which eventually emerging orthodoxy decided was the right one, or at least useful, right? It tempts us to backproject the eventual Orthodox consensus into the first century CE, when Orthodoxy didn't exist on the ground. This is a fatal historical error. Many works of non-Orthodox Christianity, or anorthodox, have slipped through the net of censorship, but what hasn't slipped through the net, as far as I'm aware, is a counter-heresiological text, a text from one of the many other flavors of Christianity. If we had, for example, writings from Valentinus, the second century theologian whom Irenaeus and others are so concerned to attack, calling him a Gnostic and so forth, if we had works by Valentinus attacking their views, well, we would have a very different window on this material. But that stuff just has been censored successfully. But the point is, there simply is no orthodoxy in the first four centuries of Christian history, except in retrospect. And I, for one, am not sure how you would ever pin down precisely when there was a consensus on orthodox belief. The Council of Nicaea? Nope. The debates really only got going once the Nicene Creed was formalized. Can we say this or that ecumenical council finally said, okay, this is Christian doctrine? No, we cannot. I mean, as we shall see in the course of these episodes, official quote-unquote doctrine about the afterlife in Christianity is still being rewritten in the High Middle Ages. And that goes for mainstream, like Catholicism. Things radically, radically change over the centuries. There is no kind of point that you can point to and go, okay, now we have a consensus. These issues evolve over thousands of years. So all of this evolving orthodoxy, which is always kind of trying to re-edit the past, is nowhere more relevant than in the study of Christian eschatology. The embarrassing elephant in the room is that while early Christianity is across all our sources very much an afterlife religion, very much a religion one of whose main selling points was a broad-scale application of something that the mystery cults had long promised to their elite esoteric memberships, namely a better state in the afterlife, in the hereafter. While that is true, no one could agree on how the Christian afterlife was supposed to work. I mean, some people could agree, but there was no kind of consensus across the board agreement, at least not for hundreds and hundreds of years. I'm going to leave that there, but gentle listeners will see what I mean as we go along, because a lot of the so-called Orthodox voices we're going to cite, like Justin Martyr, for example, say things that would be utterly condemned by, say, modern Catholics or Orthodox Christians. There's an awful lot of material, an awful lot of debate, and it turns out there's just an awful lot of early Christian reincarnationism. So the problem I face is how to arrange the material or discussion without, for example, just repeating the heresiological false distinctions between Christians and Gnostics. First, we'll discuss the Christians, then we'll discuss the Gnostics, blah, blah, blah. I've opted basically to go chronologically. First, in this episode, we are going to discuss the New Testament scriptures, some paracanonical stuff from the first century, early second century, keeping in mind that the canonicity of what's now called the New Testament or Christian Bible is something very much debated in the first centuries of Christianity. As keen listeners will recall, the early Christian teacher Marcion, often called a Gnostic by the heresiologues, he opts to accept nothing but the Pauline writings, while a wide range of Christians, now considered quite orthodox, would doubt the validity of the Apocalypse of John for many centuries. And that's just to take two examples from this like massive debate over what exactly the Christian canon is. There's also the debate about whether the Jewish writings are part of the canon or not, which is another big one. Having looked at the, you know, sort of quasi-canonical New Testament material in this episode, in the next episode, we're going to start to scan the evidence for the first 400 years or so of Christian writers and try to make sense of these documents and of the developing Christian religion as it sought to figure out what its teachings were on matters of the afterlife. It's going to be a wild ride. Now, I usually leave the comments about the next chapters in the story till the end of the episode, but let me say right here that the story of Christian reincarnationism definitively does not end with the gradual establishment of orthodoxy, whenever we want to say, you know, that sort of has taken hold. Let's say we want to say the end of the 6th century. By the time of Justinian, we can say that there is such a thing as orthodoxy. It's still hammering out some details. The councils still continue, and so on and so forth. There's still the Miaphysite versus Diophysite controversy, very much a live matter. But nevertheless, okay, we can say there's orthodoxy. It exists. At least two major late antique Christian or Christian adjacent movements will go on for centuries teaching reincarnation or something like reincarnation right in through late antiquity, right into the period we know as the early modern and maybe even the modern period, or rather teaching complex afterlife doctrines which involve reincarnation as part of the story. I refer, of course, to the Manichaeans on the one hand and the Paulicians on the other. The Manichaeans, as we know, do not die out until, well, who can say? In China, we might have evidence for Manichaeanism until the 19th century or even beyond. See our episode 123 with Jason Bedun. As for the Paulicians, they are a late antique group of Christians, universally called a heresy in our Orthodox sources, but again, they wouldn't have called themselves that. They called themselves the True Church, and they straight up believed in metempsychosis. And their beliefs seem to have had something to do with a whole flourishing of later medieval Christian heresies, in quotes, like the Bogomils and the Cathars, who also straight up taught metempsychosis. In both cases, the Manichae case and the Paulician case, and later Christian reincarnationist cases, we should be calling in expert help to disentangle the threads of evidence from the corrupting influence of heresiological polemic. And I should flag up here that nothing about the Paulician, Bogomil, or Cathar doctrine is really that straightforward in our evidence. A lot of scholars want to deny that some or all of them taught reincarnation. I don't buy this, but I'm not a specialist, so we're going to have to present the evidence in a thorough way when the time comes with some specialists who can read languages like Old Church Slavonic and Bulgarian and Armenian. But for now, rest assured, gentle listener, that while the coming few episodes will be dealing with a time frame, the early Christian period, say the first four centuries, in which it seems like reincarnation is an early Christian eschatological model in the process of being stamped out by the growing Orthodox consensus, actually Orthodoxy loses this battle in the long durée. Christian reincarnationism will go on in the history of the West into, well, the modern period, really. It's usually under threat. It's usually a doctrine taught in hiding to some degree or another. It's usually a doctrine which is in many ways esoteric, but it's always there historically in out-of-the-way places or sometimes hiding under the surface meaning of Christian texts. Okay, that's a really long intro. Let us turn now, finally, to our earliest evidence for Christian reincarnationism, and we're going to start with the Gospels. For an opening summary of eschatological matters in the New Testament writings and some early paracanonical writings like 1 Peter, rather than reinvent the wheel, I'm going to quote Jan Bremer from his delightful book, The Rise and Fall of the Afterlife, who gives a good rundown of some crucial passages to do with where you might go after you die and how long it might take to get there. Quote, "The earliest references in the New Testament to the afterlife are found in the writings of Paul, although he speaks about a fate after death in not very explicit terms. But both in his letter to the Philippians 1:22-3 and in 2 Corinthians 5:1-10, he seems to suggest that he will be with Christ immediately after his death. Among the evangelists, Luke is the only one to relate the parable of the rich man who after death stays in Hades, and poor Lazarus who was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom, 16:19-31. He is also the only one to mention Jesus' words to the robber on the cross, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise," 23:43. Luke's history of the earliest Christian church, from the birth of Jesus to Paul's enforced stay in Rome, which at an early date was divided into his Gospel and Acts of the Apostles, probably dates from the end of the first century. His interest in these words of Jesus may already reflect contemporary Christian concern about what happened after death. In the equally late 1 Peter, it is said that Christ preached to the spirits in prison, 3:19, which expression is probably derived from a description in pre-Christian 1 Enoch, 10:11-15, and which was taken by some early Christian authors as a concern for those who had died before Christ. The most detailed description in the later books of the New Testament is found in Revelation, where the author speaks of the souls of those slain because of the word of God and the witness they had borne under a heavenly altar, 6:9, and of a first resurrection, a reign of 1,000 years, 24:6, and a second definitive resurrection, when the last judgment will come, when who was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire, 20:15. The New Testament, then, has very little to say about the existence of heaven, hell, or purgatory, but concentrates its attention wholly on the resurrection and the last judgment, end of quote. Now, that last point is true at first. The New Testament has very little to say about the existence of heaven, hell, or purgatory. But I take issue with the second part, that it concentrates its attention wholly on the resurrection and the last judgment. Does it, though? I think there is instead a tension between two types of afterlife expectation evidenced in these writings across the board. And it's a tension which already we see the Apocalypse of John trying to solve with its doctrine of two resurrections, right? The first one, then the second one when the last judgment comes. So we have on the one hand the belief in the coming end of days, the kingdom of heaven, the remaking of the world, the mass resurrection of judgment of all humanity, which we are so familiar with from our Enochic and other apocalyptic sources in Second Temple Judaism. And the other, the belief that when you die, you are going to end up with Jesus pretty much straight away, right? The effort to harmonize these two strands, indeed, will pattern the entire history of Christian thinking about the hereafter. Now, it's important to situate these early Christian writings in the context of the belief that the apocalyptic final judgment and resurrection are imminent. As Jesus says in the Gospel of John 5:25, cited as always on the podcast in the sonorous King James Version, "Verily, verily, I say unto you," this is Jesus speaking, "the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, they that hear shall live." Or Matthew 3:2, "Repent ye, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." Or the clincher, Luke 21:31-32, "When ye see these things come to pass, know ye that the kingdom of God is nigh at hand. Verily, I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all be fulfilled." You could compare Matthew 24:33-4, Mark 13:30, all saying roughly the same thing. The kingdom of heaven is coming during the lifetime of some of the people who are around when Jesus is around. Now, the resurrection could be seen as so just around the corner to the initial, you know, first Jesus movement, that it would amount to an immediate presence in the afterlife, right? So the idea that when you die, you have to explain sort of what happens between your death and the resurrection, that's not a problem if the resurrection is like tomorrow. And yet, is that really what Paul means when he says he will be with Christ immediately when he dies? Maybe. This is where interpretation of the evidence is going to come in. But certainly, as time went on and the apocalypse kept not happening, this became more of a problem for Christians trying to create a theory of eschatology, right? And while we're on the subject of harmonization, there are a few other elements in the New Testament, I think, that need to be taken into account here. Very relevant for the question of reincarnation. So first of all, as we can see in these passages, there is the idea, which is found in Paul, but also in early martyr literature, like the early third century, the Passion of Perpetua, and many later texts, that believers will die and then immediately open their eyes, and there's Jesus with the martyred dead sitting on his right side and welcoming the newly martyred to the glorious afterlife. We have tons of visionary literature where people describe this, right? But then there's the notion of the final resurrection. What's going on? Are the dead alive with Jesus, but then they have to re-die so that the global eschatological resurrection can happen? Well, that is sort of the compromised position of a lot of mainstream Christianity. But as we'll see, early Christians like Justin Martyr attack that. They say, no, you when you die, you are dead until the resurrection. And that the belief that you're sort of immediately with Jesus is heresy. So if you die and the resurrection hasn't come yet, are you alive while you're in the grave, as it were? Presumably, you're not alive in your physical body, right? Because that's in the ground. So if you're not in your physical body, what then? That's a question. What about the pneumatikon soma, the spiritual body, which Paul says we are going to get? What's that all about? And at what point do we get that from God? We can adopt the Greek philosophic notion of a separable soul, which, as we've seen so far in our series, you know, lies behind so much of the thinking about reincarnation in the Greek tradition. But that raises problems, and many early Christians are very much against adopting the soul. We can also argue that the dead are asleep and that they're going to wake up at the final trumpet. The English word cemetery actually comes from, ultimately, from the Greek word koimeterion, sleeping place. But that flies in the face of Paul and the martyrs' expectations of being right there with Jesus straight after death. Unless, of course, the idea is that when you wake up after a truly dreamless sleep, after a long period of being dead, in fact, it would feel basically like immediately waking up in paradise. But a lot of Christians then and now have found this unsatisfactory. I want my afterlife immediately, not after some indeterminate period of being dead, maybe for thousands of years. Anyhow, you can see the tensions between the expectation of an individual eschatological result, on the one hand, and the apocalyptic eschaton of world renewal, on the other hand, in Christianity. Incidentally, this is also a huge tension in Islam, as we shall be getting to. But staying with the Christian tradition, compromises and harmonizations would be dreamt up in great profusion. And when we look at Christian afterlife theories of the early centuries, we see this project unfolding in real time. No one can agree on anything except that the afterlife for true believers is going to be fantastic in some way. So that's our basic status questionis in the first 4 centuries or so of Christianity. The nature of the afterlife remains a very unsettled question, but a strong hope or belief in the afterlife is one of the religion's signature features. And hardline Christians of the 2nd and 3rd centuries were famously willing to die rather than do things like eat ritually impure food or make a statement rejecting Christ. Part of this toughness, this staunchness in the face of death, must have come from their belief that death either wasn't all that bad or wasn't really death in some sense, right? Okay, now we're focused on the question of metempsychosis, reincarnation, and here the passages cited by Bremer need to be supplemented by some more crucial spots in the scriptures, ones which were often taken by Christian reincarnationists to support their position. Now, we should note here, first of all, that there are a lot of passages in the New Testament which, if you already believe in reincarnation, can be taken as supporting that belief, but which most modern scholars take to refer to the more normative Christian doctrine drawn from Second Temple Judaism of the final resurrection of the dead. Take, for example, Gospel of John 3:1 and following, and imagine that you are a Christian who believes in reincarnation, right? There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. The same came to Jesus by night and said unto him, Rabbi, we know that thou art a teacher come from God, for no man can do these miracles that thou doest, except God be with him. Jesus answered and said unto him, Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Nicodemus saith unto him, How can a man be born when he is old? Can he enter the second time into his mother's womb and be born? Jesus answered, Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. Marvel not that I said unto thee, Ye must be born again. End of quote. So, if I'm a reincarnationist, I'm reading this and saying, okay, the Spirit has to be born again, and again, and again, right? And we have ancient Christians who believe this. This reference to the Pharisees, Nicodemus is a Pharisee, this surely points us in the direction of the belief in the bodily resurrection, right? Well, as we saw last time, there is that pesky evidence from Josephus that maybe the Pharisees or some Pharisees, just believed in serial reincarnation of separable souls. Anyhow, however we want to read that evidence, the point I'm trying to make here is just that there is ample room for reading many passages from the scriptures as unmistakable references to serial reincarnation, if that is your goal. And a case study might be a book which came out in 1900 by one J.M. Price, entitled Reincarnation in the New Testament. Price is a theosophist, and he's trying to bring Christianity into the fold of the perennial wisdom, as understood by Blavatsky et al. Thus, reincarnation along roughly Indian lines is everywhere in the Gospels, as far as he's concerned. But you don't have to be a theosophist, as we shall see anon. Many passages were taken in precisely this sense by early Christians, not as a Blavatskyan appeal to the Sophia Perennis, needless to say, but just as evidence from the scriptures that reincarnation is in fact what happens after you die, or after some people die. Setting that aside for a moment, that kind of general susceptibility of many of the passages in the New Testament to a reincarnationist reading, if you want to find one, there are two main types of statement found in the Gospels, which Bremer doesn't mention, but which we need to mention in our discussion. The first is the statement in all three synoptic Gospels that Jesus, when asked whether there would be marriage after the resurrection, and, you know, presumably lying behind this question is the more salient query of whether sex is included among the pleasures of paradise, answers that no, there will be no sex because we shall be transformed into angelic beings. Matthew 22:30, for in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as angels of God in heaven. Mark 12:25, for when they shall rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels which are in heaven. And Luke 20:35-36. But they which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, neither can they die any more, for they are equal unto the angels and are children of God, being the children of the resurrection. So this brings the question of angelomorphic transformation to the table. And indeed, this is one of those things which is very well attested in the scriptures. That's 3 out of 4 gospels, right, say that we are going to become angels or angel-type beings, but which Orthodox eschatology has tended sort of to downplay. If we are believers, the scriptures say in no uncertain terms that we are going to become angels or angelic beings in the kingdom of heaven. As we shall see, for a Clement of Alexandria, this opened the doors to a deeply scriptural doctrine of angelic reincarnation, we could call it. And obviously the carn part, the flesh part in the term reincarnation may be problematic because the angels are not seen as having flesh, but they are seen as having bodies. So let's call it metempsychosis or whatever. And Origen, the great theologian of the 3rd century, who may have been Clement's student, but whether he was or not, he certainly read a lot of Clement. He seems to have been on the same track in some way. And that's to say nothing of the medieval Bogomils, Cathars, and others, for whom angelification was just the whole point of Christianity. In this life, we need to become angels now. Our second scriptural locus is the point at Matthew 11:14, where Jesus says of John the Baptist, "And if you will receive it, this is Elias, which was for to come." Or Matthew 16:14, "And they said, some say that thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, and others Jeremias, or one of the prophets." We could compare Mark 6:15, 8:28, and at Luke 9:8, we learn that when Herod had John the Baptist killed, all manner of rumors started to abound about John's identity, including that Elias had appeared, and of others that one of the old prophets was risen again. So our writers of gospel narratives are assuming a background belief among the Jews in the 1st century in Palestine that prophets, Elijah most especially, but other prophets as well, are going to return. Now, remember, Elijah is, along with Enoch, one of those prophets who never actually dies. In the case of Enoch, we just are told that God took him, and it's very cryptic. In the case of Elijah, in 2 Kings 2:11, we learn that it came to pass that, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. So Elijah is the kind of guy you'd expect to maybe be somewhere planning a big comeback, right? Since he never dies. But the fact that some people speculate that John might be Elijah or another prophet points to the direction of that specifically Second Temple belief in a kind of reincarnation, which we spoke about in part 4, namely the reincarnation of the returning prophet. So both of these ideas, angelification and the returning prophet, are very relevant specifically to various Christians of antiquity who will eventually be semi-condemned or utterly condemned as heretics, because basically they're teaching some kind of reincarnationist idea about the afterlife. Now, what do Christians begin to make of all this material in formulating Christian ideas about the hereafter? That will be the subject of the next episode. We shall discuss a number of thinkers from the early centuries of Christian thought whose work shows that they taught reincarnation of some kind, and this will include a star-studded list of well-known so-called Gnostics like Basilides and Carpocrates of Alexandria, as well as a number of texts without known authors, like the Pistis Sophia. But it's also going to include crucially important proto-Orthodox thinkers like Clement and Origen. And to balance things out, we shall also be discussing the anti-reincarnationist polemics from people like Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, and the author of The Refutation of All Heresies, who have a lot to tell us about what was really going on in early Christianity, vis-a-vis eschatology and notions of transmigration. That'll be part 7. In part 8, we're going to focus on Origen and the question of reincarnationism in his thought with expert help. In part 9, we shall discuss the later history of Origenism, both in works like Vagaris of Pontus, a truly fascinating esoteric Christian thinker, and also the polemical construction of Origenism as a kind of enemy of Orthodoxy, which taught a bunch of stuff like the preexistence of souls and cyclical reincarnation and the spherical resurrection body, the spherical noetic resurrection body, a favorite of mine, which is a polemical construction which is, you know, very important for the history of Western esotericism in a number of ways, as we shall see. After that, we shall back up to the 3rd century again and cover the Manichaeans and their eschatology, which is actually a totally unique synthesis which we can profitably discuss in terms of reincarnation, but it's not your grandma's reincarnation. And there we shall see a very strong reappearance of astral afterlife themes into our story. That's what's to come in the near future, but the story only gets more interesting from there. So stay with us and stay esoteric.